Crazy SUFM Stanford, welcome. It's another edition of Hearsay Culture on the Hearsay Culture Network and KZSU-FM. Today we are covering a topic that we have covered quite a bit in the nearly 19-year history of Hearsay Culture, which is both algorithmic computing and also data. And you might be immediately thinking, if you're a longtime listener of Hearsay Culture, God, Levine, another book about data and algorithms. But no, I'm going to say to you folks, this is a different kind of book because while there have been many books written about data and about privacy and about algorithms, this book, The Secret Life of Data, Navigating Hype, Uncertainty in the Age of Algorithmic Surveillance, co-authored by Aram Sinrich and Jesse Gilbert, is a little bit different. Now, I'm going to share my immediate caveat when, as I mentioned to the authors in our pre-interview, when Shiva Vaidyanathan says a book is good, I pretty much say, okay, it's good enough for me. But I'm going to read Shiva's backflap quote because I think it sums up why this book is a bit different. Shiva wrote, "I've been waiting a long time for a clearly written book that cuts through the hype and describes how data, big and small, old and new, actually operate in our lives." Okay, that's pretty good. And we've seen books like that too. But neither utopian nor dystopian, The Secret Life of Data just tells it like it is. And that's what makes this book different. We have been discussing issues involving data and algorithms on Hearsay Culture going back its entire history. Of course, these issues are more pronounced today, June 10th, 2024, in light of generative AI's thrusting upon society just a couple of years ago. But what we tend to hear is either not only the sky is falling, but the world may very well come to an end because either privacy is not protected or algorithms will take over the world. Or conversely, we have other authors and commentators who are focusing almost exclusively on the positive and good uses of technology and the challenges of privacy that are minimized without really getting into what the downsides might be. And I've been present, and I'm sure the authors have too, in presentations where 40 minutes of the presentation is here's what's great about this technology, and the last minute is, but there might be a couple of things to think about, and then people are left with what do we do about this? So this book does something different. This book runs through a number of case studies defining the terminology at the beginning of what that secret life is. What is the secret life of data? Now, much of it may not be secret these days if you are in the world that Jesse and I are, right, as people that focus in these areas. So they're not secret in that sense, but they are certainly secret to those who are not immersed in this space. And even so, some of this information is in fact secret. We don't know how much of these algorithms operate. The authors in their introduction define the secret life of data, and I'm not going to steal their thunder because I'm about to start asking a few questions, but I'm just going to quote their book. This is on page 7 of the introduction. "The basic premise is simple," they write, "though its implications are complex. There is no limit to the amount and variety of data, and ultimately knowledge, that may be produced from an object, event, or interaction given enough time, distance, and computational power," which sounds very physical and very physics-like or physics-like. But they then, I think, rephrase it for those that have to think about that one for a moment. In even plainer language, they write, "It means that whatever we think we're sharing when we upload a selfie, write an email, shop online, stream a video, look up driving directions, track our sleep, like, in quotes, a post, write a book, or spit into a test tube, that's only the tip of the proverbial iceberg." And so the book then digs into that iceberg, helping us think ultimately about where we should be concerned, where we might be concerned, and where perhaps we don't need to be as concerned as we think we need to be. Aram Sinrich is an author, professor, and musician, chair of the Communication Studies Department at American University, has written several books that sadly I have never interviewed Aram, which I'm mildly embarrassed given the titles of your books, Mashed Up, The Privacy Crusade, The Essential Guide to IP, which is probably the most upsetting to me since I teach in the area, and A Second Chance of Yesterday. Jesse Gilbert is an interdisciplinary artist exploring the intersection of visual art, sound, and software design at his firm Dark Matter Media. He was the founding chair of Media Technology Department at Woodbury University and has taught interactive software design at both Cal Arts and UC San Diego. Aram and Jesse, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Great to be here.
So I'm going to jump right in with this subtitle, Navigating Hype Uncertainty. And I talked a lot about hype uncertainty in the age of algorithmic surveillance. The visceral reaction is, boy, shouldn't we be nervous about algorithmic surveillance? And yet you point out throughout the book, and I've mentioned in the introduction, that there's a lot of hype around it. So what is that hype?
First of all, funny story. This whole book has been plagued with metadata errors. What makes that funny is that our whole first chapter is
Yeah,
about
it's called
metadata.
that
So actually, the title that you just read out loud is a metadata error. The actual subtitle of the book is begins Navigating Hype and Uncertainty.
Oh my God. So Aram, I didn't want to be a rude interviewer because the question I was going to ask, and I decided this isn't the BBC Hard Talk or something like that, is I'm not sure I understand the subtitle. So, okay. Because I thought hype uncertainty is kind of a cool concept,
It's a
right?
cool concept, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a hip hop promoter, right?
It's either a hip hop promoter, right? Or I was saying, well, there's hype, but I'm kind of uncertain about what the hype is. And how. Okay, all right, which would have been a lot of fun. All right, hi, that's great. Well, look, these things happen with the book. I could
Yes.
tell you that the book is still well worth reading, notwithstanding the typo on the cover. All right, hype
They
and
actually fixed it
uncertainty.
before they rolled it out. You've got a promotional
Oh,
copy,
I've
which
got
is
it. I'm
now a collector's
about to
edition.
say, I have to get it,
Exactly.
and I'll put it on eBay. All right, so
Yeah.
I've got a review copy, folks. Okay,
Yes.
hype, navigating hype and uncertainty. I can still ask the
Yes.
question though. I think we've talked a little bit about the hype and a little bit of the uncertainty, but now we can differentiate between the two. So, what is that hype and uncertainty?
Well, I think it's a great question, and thank you so much for that introduction. It's great to have someone lay that out for us. A lot of what Aram and I did in thinking about the book and researching it, writing it, speaking to a bunch of experts is really trying to get underneath what is the practice now? How do people think about what they do when they're working in these data fields? And I think there's a real tension, as you pointed out, between kind of the marketing points of view, the ways that technology has boosted the kind of utopian vision of technology, or the vision that is spun in the marketing of the tech in order to get us to more fully embrace it, to bring it into our intimate lives, to bring it into our workplaces, to bring it into the decisions that we're making on a daily basis. And I think that this push that the tech industry has made over the last, several decades to really move from, personal computing to this kind of mass deployment on a global scale of networks, and how we have really embraced tech, is driven by that utopianism and by that kind of frontier mentality, right? So navigating the hype is also making smart choices about what we do decide to do. It's about thinking, together about what is really being done with us, with the data that we produce, with the our actions and our intimate connections, and making choices that are informed. And I think the book is really trying to present, as you said, a balanced picture of kind of, there is an upside to tech. We can't deny that. That's kind of would be foolish at this point. There's also no off switch, right? So we have to think clearly together about that. And part of the issue is that more people, aside from those of us who are experts in these fields, we need more people involved in that conversation. The book is really aimed at helping everyday people make sense of what is going on, make sense of what the data is that they're creating and how it's being used, and also thinking about the uncertain future of the data that is produced. And that's, I think, the central point of the secret life principle that you just read, which is that there's really no telling what the data is going to become, right? Knowledge is, and information is produced from the data that may be, a decade or two down the line. We live in an age of ubiquitous storage as well, not just computing, but the price of storage has plummeted so far that everyone who is recording the data is just deciding to keep it forever. And a new business model, a new political, circumstance, will arise in which that data may be valuable. And that value that they derive from that is something that can cause us a lot of uncertainty as to, you know, how do we best protect ourselves? How do we best navigate this new landscape that really wasn't clear when we began down this road? You know, storage was immensely expensive. You know, computing power was not ubiquitously available, right? We have more power on a you know, smartphone that we're carrying in our pocket than, you know, dozens of computers that we had, you know, back in the 80s, right? So this is really a new landscape. And for many of us, sort of the conceptual framework, the way we think about our lives, which is now so completely immersed in this data field, hasn't evolved to the point where we can kind of, you know, effectively navigate that landscape.
You know what, Aram, as and I know I'm not talking to lawyers, so I don't want you to get nervous because it just sound very lawyerly. What I think you're talking about here, the secret is really the harms, right? It's the uses as opposed to the collection itself. In other words, I think it's fair to say that at least not even sophisticated, but even maybe moderately sophisticated users of technology today kind of have a sense that data is being collected about them. I mean, I think maybe 15 years ago, maybe not so much. But what I think you're talking about here is that the harms, right? With the harms deriving that are unpredictable, the uses perhaps, those are the quote unquote secrets. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, harms is one important framework to look at, because what we are looking at, a lot of what we discuss in the book is the kind of undermining of democratic norms, the kind of infiltration of intimate relationships with data systems, acceleration of bias and error, and you know, to a certain extent, malevolence through the institutionalization of algorithms in our justice systems, our medical systems, our financial systems, our educational systems, and so on. But it's more than just the harms. The point is that even the highly educated, highly capitalized actors that are designing these systems and collecting and storing and analyzing the data today have no idea what's going to become of the data a couple years down the line, right? And, you know, if you look at, you know, social media platforms like WordPress or Tumblr or Meta that are now taking, you know, what's 2 decades worth of social media data and feeding it into machine learning algorithms, because there's a glut on, you know, in order to get to GPT-5, we're going to need to absorb another trillion data points. You know, those systems were not built for the purpose of training AI. And only in the 2020s has the the terabytes and terabytes of data that they've collected been turned towards those uses. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be thinking about that from an advanced perspective as well. The data that we are collecting now, which is, you know, orders of magnitude greater and more diverse than what we were feeding into our social media profiles in the aughts and teens, will also have these future uses that we can't predict. And so there's no way for us to conceptually wrap our heads around the meaning of consent in that kind of an environment. And it's very difficult equally for the businesses that we're transacting those data with today to be ethical, right? I mean, like, we're living in the era of the GDPR, where like every freaking, like an ethical website is one that puts a cookie wall up in front of you, demanding that you accept cookies before you go on to check your bank balance or health records. And, you know, that's really not adequate to address the, as you say, the harms or the other kind of social consequences that'll emerge when those data are not expunged, and either the companies that we gave them to or third parties that have one way or another gotten access to those data down the line, use them for an entirely new purpose that we couldn't even give permission for now because it doesn't exist. So I think I get why from a legal standpoint you'd want to focus on harms, and that's a very real and important framework, especially when it comes to policy and regulation. But a concept that we spend a lot of the book pushing is that this is not a wonky abstract subject. Right. This changes the way that parents relate to children, and that lovers meet and sustain a relationship over the course of a lifetime. This changes the way that we understand ourselves in terms of our identities, in terms of our relationships to our own bodies. There is no human cultural system that is not thoroughly being datafied at the moment, and therefore that's not subject to the whims of future actors once new uses are found for those data.
And so building right off of that, Jesse, I'm going to quote your book again on this point, because this is something I wanted to ask you about, and Aram has set it up. You write, for better or for worse, you're talking about the stack, which for those that aren't familiar, right, are the more or less the layers that create the internet and create computing technology and so forth. For better or for worse, the stackification, which I'll ask you to explain a little bit more in a moment, of our bodies and our environment likely means that the physical world will inhabit and will start to behave more and more like the internet. And our offline and online experiences will become less and less distinguishable from one another. Now, I read that one and I thought, whoa, wow, I've got to ask the question. I was going to ask it later, Aram, but since you teed it up so nicely, I'm going to ask Jesse, can you explain how our physical lives look more and more, or could look more and more like the internet?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a very important sort of downstream consequence of this notion of ubiquitous computing, which back in the 90s was kind of like a pipe dream of a lot of technology, you know, boosters, right? The idea that we are surrounded by sensors, we are carrying biometric devices, we are, you know, engaging in wide-scale video surveillance in urban areas, we are, you know, essentially creating a data-rich environment that spills out beyond the borders that we used to think that computing occupied, right? So, you know, we would think of them as, you know, I have a laptop, I have a computer in my, you know, my office, I might have a smartphone, but you know, those are sort of contained environments. Mm-hmm. And what really happens when you build out a, you know, the implications of the sort of emergent, almost fractal networks that we have built, which are, you know, now it is, you know, impossible to run a public business without providing Wi-Fi, right? Mm-hmm. We have ubiquitous 5G networks. We have you know, doorbell cameras and dash cams. We have sensors that are, you know, governing, you know, and observing how we are driving, right? We have not only moved beyond what we had thought of as kind of the playing field for technology, but we have really, it has pervaded almost every aspect of what we would call sort of daily activities, and to the point that, you know, it's, we have biometric sensors that are now being used for shopping or to pay for, you know, a metro ride. We have face tracking that is deployed in a number of levels in law enforcement, and you know, you have to consent to that when you're going to through an airport. You might have to consent to that at a business. Provision of all of this, it is the groundwork. That then what we're trying to point out is that, you know, the idea of a stack, which is essentially the, yep, you know, the bridging between the physical and the mm-hmm. logical layers within a computing system mm-hmm. has been greatly expanded. And in fact, we have to understand it as a networked metaphor now, where effectively there are peers within all of that, and we are only part of that system. It, even if you decided you didn't want to carry a phone or wear a biometric device, we are still implicated if you have any kind of activity within this sort of datafied society. You are part of that, and also the people around you are part of it. So your networks, social, personal, professional, are all effectively, you know, reporting on your behavior without you participating, right? So if you think of AirTags, for example, which is a popular example that you know, has a very clear utility for us, you know, to find lost objects, to find items that are of value that we might have left behind. And we think about, well, how is this actually working, that this AirTag is reporting its location to me? I am not near it. Mm-hmm. I have not placed it into a computing network. There is an ambient network, typically piggybacking off of other people's devices as they mm-hmm. carry them. Right. And effectively what we have done is extended out the terms of service to say, if I have an AirTag, I have the right to piggyback onto anyone's data network and provide that location. And effectively, when I purchase a phone or, you know, decide I want to activate that, what I am saying is I give permission to become an ambient computing device for other purposes that I might have no idea about, right? I mm-hmm. might be walking through an airport and reporting on your bag that you've left behind. This is the sort of expansion of the business case and the use case, and also kind of the acquiescence to this ambient environment that we're now living in, which we obviously get benefit from. But I think we have to ask the question of what are the implications of this, and what other uses could there be?
So just to add on to your question, Dave. Mm-hmm. So you asked, like, what does that mean for us as human mm-hmm. beings living mm-hmm. in a social and cultural environment?
And also what it means that, generally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, that we now live within the internet rather than the internet living within our devices. Mm-hmm. And so think about, like, the kind of language and logical structure of the internet that we've grown used to with our point-and-click mice and our touch screens, where one object might link to another object. Mm-hmm. Or if you want more information about something, you can hover over it and get the metadata, right? Or look at the properties of it. Those kinds of links are now more and more permeating our physical world. So, you know, right now in New York City and Dublin, there's a thing called the Portal, which mm-hmm. You may have talked about previously on your show, mm-hmm. which is essentially a huge interactive audiovisual display right. that creates a kind of sense of physical co-presence between pedestrians in these two cities that are thousands of miles away from each other. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of, right now it's a gimmick, right? But more and more and more and more, and especially once we adopt more kind of immersive technologies like, you know, VR and mixed reality and stuff like that, the physical proximity and physical experience will become secondary to, or just one more layer in, this kind of, like, heightened proprioceptive networked experience of being alive, where people in Dublin or in Guangdong or in Myanmar might be just as physically present to you and informationally present to you as somebody passing you on the street. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not as simple as, well, you know, back in the 90s, it was like, now I can write an email, and anyone can receive it, or I can put up a website and anyone can access it. No, it's not that at all. It's that all of the kind of social hierarchies that begin with proximity get overturned and upturned. Mm-hmm. And the kind of presumptive anonymity that people have enjoyed in cities for hundreds, if not thousands of years, goes completely out the window. So, you know, right now you go to a website, you're curious as to, like, oh, what's that cool sweater that someone's wearing? You click on it, you get the information. Oh, I could buy the sweater at H&M for $79. Here's a link. Mm-hmm. We are now years, not decades, away from being able to do that in the real world. You mm-hmm. see somebody walking down the street holding a cool audio device. You look at that audio device and you are presented with the opportunity to purchase that device yourself. You're walking down the street and you wonder what this building is. You look at the building and the metadata overlays that building instantaneously and tells you who owns it, when it was built, what businesses it contains, how much it costs to enter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So these kinds of point and click and link and hover and metadata experiences we're used to from the web are now going to be part of our lived experience on a daily basis. Oh, you run into somebody at a party, you no longer have to say, oh yeah, I think, remind me how to spell your name, because you don't mm-hmm. actually remember what their name is. My name is Dave. Oh, Dave, mm-hmm. I was wondering how it's pronounced, yeah. Right? No, because like your entire LinkedIn is going to be, you know, floating above your head as soon as I see you at the party. I'll be like, Dave, how's your wife, Marjorie? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Are you enjoying your radio show? I'm going to know everything mm-hmm. about you before I even talk to you. Right. Mm-hmm. And that means that all of the kind of negative downstream consequences that come from being on the internet, the trollery, the hacking, the surveillance, all the kind of stuff that we cringe at and are so happy to put down our phones and turn off our laptops because we get away from it, will be inescapable. Those will be lived dimensions of there's no place we will go that Russian trolls can't mess with, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To put a fine point on it, in our yeah. daily lives. And, you know, even if you look at the kind of non-malicious but annoying stuff about the internet, like 404 errors when you mm-hmm. go to a website and the website's down and it's not working, or link rot, where somebody links one web page to another, but then the second yep. web page disappears and the link is dead. Right. All those kinds of problems and errors that the internet is rife with will now be part of our lived daily experience that make, and as we come to rely on this kind of hyperlinked cultural and social experience, more and more and more, those kinds of errors will impinge on more and more and more of our needs and expectations from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep.
We're chatting with Aram Sinrich and Jesse Gilbert, authors of the book, The Secret Life of Data, Navigating Hype and Uncertainty in an Age of Algorithmic Surveillance, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners to continue its programming. Please email our underwriting department at donate@kzsu.stanford.edu and check out hearsayculture.com for all the additional shows and programs, including the show with my dear friend Denise Howell, host of the show on Even Distribution, and our show R&D with D&D. So Aram, you've painted now what sounds dystopian, even though initially I thought maybe we were more balanced, and I'm teasing you a little bit, because I let me push back for a moment and say, and I'll go to you, Jesse. So the old saw, you know, which involved television, was turn off the TV. Is the suggestion, therefore, that, and I'm going to use the extreme, although I agree, not necessarily that far in the future possibility, because we saw Google Glass, for example, start and fail, but then there are apparently new efforts on the way. Can I, in the world that Aram described, opt out? Now, maybe I can't opt out of my data, right, being in that space. But in the world that we envision based upon, right, algorithmic surveillance and the secret life, is there a way that you could conceive where I, Dave Levine, or Aram, or Jesse could say, you know what, I'm going to meet you the old-fashioned way, which is simply to walk up to you and say, hello, what is your name?
Yeah, I mean, certainly people are going to have all kinds of options of that, again, to determine what technologies they're going to invite into their daily lives, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the point that we're making is that as these infrastructures are built out and, you know, scaled to a societal level, it's going to be harder and harder to do. And mm-hmm. from a data standpoint, yes, there really is no opt-out at this point. We can triangulate between data points, and we can, you know, the researchers have shown how easy it is to de-anonymize data. I do think that the other thing, though, that again, we're being faced with some of those sort of, you know, knife edge type decisions, which is really, you know, if you're participating in business or in social discourse, you know, opting in to that is part of a fundamental decision that you have to make. So interestingly, Aram has opted out of a number of social media platforms mm-hmm. in his practice. And I think that in a certain way, obviously, we have the ability to do that. But the point is also that we are implicated in this web of data, whether we are participating actively or not, right? Mm-hmm. We have examples of, for example, if you think about DNA, you know, genealogy sites, right, where effectively this is an informational network, right? If you think about it from that perspective, that, you know, if you have relatives that participate in this, you effectively are participating in that. Now, that can have positive outcomes, as in the case of, you know, tracking down cold cases where serial killers have not been able to be found through direct evidence. And, you know, their relatives participating in a genealogy site have actually led to, as in the case of the Golden State Killer, that led them to identify the culprit.
Yeah.
But the other issue is that I think what we're really trying to do is raise sort of more of a provocative question, which has to do with understanding that there are more mundane, everyday use cases of that type of action where, you know, we interviewed someone whose father had found out that he was unwittingly the father of another child that he never mm-hmm. knew about. And mm-hmm. that had happened without his participation in the DNA database process. It only happened because his relatives had opted in.
Right.
And what I think is interesting about that conversation is, rather than going into kind of a binary point of view here, which is to say, you know, this is a good or bad thing, is to say, you know, well, how do we balance the rights of the person who was searching for his biological parents via a genealogy database with the privacy of the person who hasn't even participated in it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think the point we're making here is that, you know, our ethics and our sort of conversation at a societal level hasn't caught up with the capabilities of the technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And that effectively you can actually balance both points of view. So you can say that, you know, certainly someone has the right to research, you know, if they were put up for adoption or if they, you know, they didn't know their parents, they have a right to do that. And we can all probably put ourselves in that, in those shoes and say, you know, if I was in that place, I would probably want to know. And then we can also balance that with, well, what happens to someone who suddenly has kind of like a life altering identity moment where they find out about a child they didn't know about without actually having made a decision to participate in this technological framework,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that, you know, the question there is that person didn't have an opt out, right? They can't, mm-hmm. you know, unless we are saying that we all have the right to control each other's behavior and say, well, you shall not participate in this because of a hypothetical revelation that may happen downstream, is really to say that, you know, as these data systems grow and as we participate more and more in them, there will be more and more of these kinds of questions that arise, which have to do with the social reality of our, you know, lived experience, right? Where we have all of these networks, whether we think of them as data networks or social or, you know, physical spaces that we inhabit, that actually implicate us in this process. And what we really need to do, rather than thinking that we can just say no to it all, is to have a more open and nuanced conversation about it, where we are balancing the rights of companies to, you know, scale and to offer services, and the rights of individuals to maintain a kind of sense of self, and thinking about what, you know, what happens when these are in tension.
So
I was going to say, I mean, what Jesse's describing is that's the best case scenario, right? Because that presumes that everybody has transparency and political power and the ability to opt in or out. But there are a number of case studies we talk about in the book where those are not the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, while the U.S. was in Afghanistan between 2003 and 2020 or whatever it was, or 21, the US and the UN built a genetic database of basically everybody on the ground in the country.
Right.
Like 6 out of 7 people were in this genetic database, and aid was contingent on participating in that database. And it contained not just people's genetic profiles, but all of the metadata about their lives, where they lived, how old they were, who was in their family, whether they'd cooperated with the American military. And then the US pulled out of Afghanistan and left the databases behind. And within a week, the Taliban had access to all of it.
Right.
And all of a sudden, like, all these American collaborators were, like, you know, identifiable via genetic information, via facial recognition, and so on. And at no point in time, and this is on record from the US military itself, had anybody thought, well, what's going to happen with these data after we collect them and after we have our way with them, right? And if you want to go even more into the kind of compulsive side of it, the coercive side of it, you know, right now, for the last 6 years or so in China, police have been intercepting people who are suspected of belonging to the Uyghur ethnic mm-hmm. minority and mm-hmm. collecting their biometric data to feed into a database against future forms of surveillance and oppression, just, you know, in order to have those data on hand and to be able to process them and to analyze them in ways that will lead to even more kind of dystopian outcomes, such as what's sometimes referred to as an ethnic alarm, where based on their genetic profiles, the anticipated faces of people belonging to an ethnic minority are fed into facial recognition databases, and then police are empowered to intercept people suspected of belonging to those minorities on the streets just based on the algorithm having pinged them, right? So, if you want to look at what Sam Altman is doing with WorldCoin, which is, you know, going into like desperately poor and needy communities in the so-called developing world and basically giving people cryptocurrency in exchange for an eye scan, knowing that the value to his company of those eye scans is going to exceed the value on the marketplace of the cryptocurrency, right? Mm-hmm. And none of these data collection points of presence involve even the people who are doing the data collecting actually thinking through the long-term consequences of the data that they're capturing.
I would suggest that the challenge, it's a bit even more complicated than that, which is kind of where I want to follow up here, right? We're talking about, we haven't brought it up yet, we're talking about private entities for the most part, right, who are developing these technologies. And you draw this distinction in the introduction and repeatedly in the book. The internet, having been developed by DARPA, had inculcated in it, just because it's a federal government entity, public values. You referred to OpenAI, which ironically is hardly open, but is driven by Sam Altman's and Bill Gates or the Microsoft's, right, pecuniary interests, i.e. profit making. So the challenge here, it seems to me, and this is why I want to ask you, RM or Jesse, right, is if we agree that these are problems, which I think not everyone would, by the way, but many would, but if we agree that they are problems, is the problem really that they're not thought about, or is that they're just not that important because we are operating the entire technological ecosystem's development or innovation process primarily through the lens of profit making, primarily through the lens of who's first, as we know, right? And who can capture the market as quickly as possible. Going back to this is way too long a question, so I'm gonna stop it this way.
It's a good one, though.
It's a good, yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I the edited version of me says you should have asked this question in about 80% less words. But okay, you brought up the example in the beginning, right, of data being collected by Facebook, by Meta, which is now being used for entirely perhaps unanticipated, right, use, which is training generative artificial intelligence, right? But of course, from a contract perspective, I suspect this is true, but certainly from a private interest perspective, the answer is, well, we own the data and we can do what we want with it. So isn't this, I'm not sure who to ask this question to, Aaron, I'm not sure there is an answer, frankly, but is the challenge here more that it's not thought about, or that isn't on the radar screen because it's not a concern to the people that are creating
circle.
The technology? Yeah.
It's a vicious circle. Not only is it in the interest of a lot of these state and commercial actors not to think through it too hard, but they have a fiduciary duty not to, right? In order to maximize the kind of probability space for future profitability, they have to, the collectors of the data have to be open to as many possible uses for as much possible data as they can, mm-hmm. right? And as Jesse alluded to before, the geometrically plummeting price of storage means that that basically everything that happens within range of a network sensor gets stored forever, mm-hmm. And infinitely recopied and reanalyzed and recombined with other data sets. And we have that from the CEO of a major data brokerage company who told us that, who said, mm-hmm. It's worth, the storage costs so little, it's worth more to us to hang on to everything than to try to parse through and figure out what's valuable and what isn't, because right. We don't know in advance what will be or what won't. So all of this takes place and can only take place in an environment that doesn't have either a robust regulatory approach to data, rooted in human rights law and the kind of civil rights consequences of data usage, and be a kind of common ethical parlance to discuss the consequences of data at the kind of human level, right? And obviously, like, you're a law professor, you know the relationship between mm-hmm. law and ethics is complex,
yeah.
but there
mm-hmm.
is one, right? Mm-hmm. So the mm-hmm. more of a conversation we have about this at the ethical level, the stronger support and clarity there will be for a comprehensive regulatory approach to minimizing the potential harms of these data systems. Mm-hmm. And that's why we wrote the book, is you can't have You can't have successful policy with actual consequences unless you have widespread voter support for those kinds of policies. And you can't have widespread voter support until the voters actually know what's at stake and are able to internalize it.
Well, and that's where I want to go in the last 50 or so minutes we have. This comment reminds me of a wonderful book whose author I had in the show a number of years ago, Shannon Valor's book, Technology and the Virtues, which gets to these issues of ethics and the work that I've done through Princeton Center for Information or Information Policy and Ed Felton's work on ethics in computing all come to this point. Jesse, I want to ask you. The documentary from a few years ago on Netflix, Coded Bias, which I'm confident you've seen, and if listeners haven't seen, it's highly recommended. One of the commentators, and I should have pulled the name, and I apologize to listeners for not having it, but one of the commentators in this wonderful documentary that's a few years old now, but still highly relevant, you know, pointed out more or less that we put chips in our, where we can put microchips in our pets, you know, our dogs and cats, in order to track them, and that this commentator doesn't want to be a pet. In other words, I don't want a chip in me. And it raises, I think, a fundamental question to which is a thread throughout your book, which is ultimately, what does it mean to be human in this kind of environment? So here's the question I want to ask you, Jesse. The ethics of putting a chip in a dog, you know, are certainly palpable. But when we're talking about putting a chip in a human being, right, you know, certainly human beings are more concerned about that, and we should be more concerned as a society. However, some people want chips. And some people may want to have that benefit. Now, you alluded to this earlier. And so here's the question. This balancing to which your book gets into, which is why I think the book stands out in the literature that we have, is highly complex. So in 12 minutes or so, I want to talk about what that balancing might look like. Yeah, we'll solve it in 12 minutes here on the Hearsay Culture Network. What does that balancing look like? I'm going to use the microchip example, Jesse. So in a world where we are choosing, right, using ethics and values and regulation and law and humanity as our vectors, what does the process look like to choose whether a chip goes into a human being? And I'm not talking Elon Musk and that kind of stuff, which I just want to leave aside completely.
Yes, please.
It's an interesting question and interesting framing. If you'll forgive me, I'm going to push back a little bit on that.
Oh, go ahead. Sure.
Yeah, because I think that effectively, you know, what that question does is, you know, we can frame this as kind of an intrusive action, right? Like, you know, incorporating something into our bodies. But the reality is that whether we do that, go to that extent, which was, you know, kind of in vogue in the era when people were talking about cyborgian, you know, identity. But effectively, what we've done, you know, through the sort of incorporation of all of these different kinds of, you know, biometric sensors, participation in a regime of data collection, whether it's at a personal level down to our physical bodies, or if it's our bodily cycles, it's our emotional cycles, our purchasing habits, all of those effectively, to me, the key point here is that by participating both in this kind of regime of data collection and then data analysis, right? So I think we have to maybe talk about this from a conceptual level for a second in order to get to the answer. And one of the things that I think we take great pains in the book to do is to differentiate between data and information.
Yeah.
And information fundamentally, so first of all, data itself is subject to bias in terms of the regime of collection itself, the ideological, technological frameworks that define what data is collected and how. And so we should not sort of overly, you know, hype data as itself being an unbiased thing, which you hear all the time. You
right.
know, that there's no data, there's no bias in data. It's just, you know, what you do with it. Well, right. No, it's actually very much determined by the framework that was used to create that data collection regime.
And Jesse, I'm going to interrupt you with your own words, by the way, because you define data in the book as discrete quantitative values extracted from larger, more complex phenomena.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Which I think, again, is in some sense a neutral description. I think it's accurate for the purposes of the argumentation, but it's not what it doesn't get to, and which we do get to later in the book, is that actually that data collection process itself is implicated in sort of human concepts of what is important, right? What are the privileged points of view that are reflected in the data that we actually collect? Mm-hmm. But once the data is collected, we are actually also moving into the information space. And what that really implies, from my point of view, I think Aaron would probably agree to this, is a contextual knowledge, you know, essentially an acknowledgement that the data has to be applied in a point in space and time in a specific cultural moment, and to the degree that we have technologies that can sort of actualize that informational creation. And so, you know, we have things where you can sort of locate information in time. You know, if you think about like the ways that camera looks over time, you know, film to video to you know, cell phone to volumetric capture, right? These are all placed in time. They have a certain cultural presence. And I think that actually is kind of a better way to frame what we're talking about with Secret Life, because what we are saying is that informational transformation can happen repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And it itself is generative of new forms of data, which will feed back into the process, right? So I think that what we're really trying to come up here with is a framework of course, we have data, information, we have quote unquote knowledge, which
by
is
the way, can I define, I'm sorry to interrupt you again. I'm going to define these terms as well. See, contracts, yeah. Professor, I warned you before, but now please. I'm doing it. Yes. You define information as those mathematical values put into context, as you just alluded to, and thereby given a social meaning, whereas knowledge are actionable inferences made from information by interested parties such as governments, marketers, or researchers. Okay, you can continue.
And to strain the metaphor a little bit, I think what we're really, you know, ultimately asking in the book, and, you know, inference, for example, you know, which is a sort of hot topic when you're thinking about AI systems, right, which go beyond just informational systems, but they're actually used for certain types of actions. To strain the metaphor here, the question that we're really asking is, in that chain, you know, we would hope to be leading towards wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. Knowledge, inference, experience, application of that in a certain moment. Do we have the wisdom to find the balance here, to, as a society, have an open conversation that is inclusive beyond just the borders of policymakers and technocrats, where we are actually collectively saying, you know, just because we can do this, it doesn't mean we should. Mm-hmm. Just because we have the capability to do it doesn't mean that we should always pull the trigger. And at the very minimum, as we operationalize new technology regimes, which we are obviously going to be doing, and which are in active development all over the world, we need to be asking these questions together of what is really at stake here? What can we do to mitigate the harms? And so for me, what we've kind of arrived at in a lot of these conversations we've had is really that we're at a mitigation phase. We're at a phase where there isn't an off switch. We can't opt out. We've signed the devil's bargain here, and there are a lot of benefits to that. But can we identify and come to some agreements about where those most egregious harms may lie, and can we mitigate those? And I think that's actually a balance that we have to reach, even just from an environmental standpoint. If you think about those kinds of implications, we need to really be actively developing that, and that should probably become part of, I think we're arguing that needs to become part of the language that the technology industry uses internally to frame a business model and not just view them as externalities. Right? Yeah, there's a very clever language that's been developed to effectively just offload all notion of consequence to a new business model. And we need to bring that back into the conversation.
Onto the consumers themselves for the most part.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Aram. I mean, in light of this, right? I mean, there's, you know, I recognizing that you're not policymakers, you're not writing a book that says here are statutes. So I want to be clear about that. You've not only identified, but I think explained very well what the issues are and how they can be thought about. And that has a value in its own right, even if none of us here have solutions. But let me ask you this question, right? And going off what Jesse just said, we have a relatively new moniker for those who raise concerns about AI, and the word which I'm sure everyone here has heard is doomers, the doomers. Yeah. And I haven't asked anyone this question yet because it's such a relatively new term, but I think the two of you are the person per people to ask, right? As I understand the term doomer, right? A doomer is someone who views AI as ending the world and doesn't see the positive uses at all, and ultimately has a cynical and pessimistic, and here an older phrase that was used to identify anyone who criticized the internet, Luddite perspective on technology. What's your reaction? By the way, first, tell me if you think I'm defining it correctly, because that may not be the right definition, but that's my understanding.
You're absolutely defining
yep,
it correctly.
Okay. All right. So go on. What do we make of doomer as what I view to be a dismissive view of many legitimate concerns with regard to technology, which doesn't diminish their positive uses?
The problem with this kind of language of doomerism is that it's very polarizing. It contrasts people who are putatively interested in innovation, in thinking about the future, against people who want to prevent the future from happening and who have to, you know, either get with the program or have the march of progress just kind of pave over the remains of their bodies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that presumes a kind of language of inevitability that's not necessary. And that really only benefits parties who don't want us asking questions and don't want us putting up obstacles to them achieving the kinds of future that they want. Mm-hmm. So the way that Jesse and I avoid this false binary between doomerism and boomerism, or between innovation and Ludditism, is by reminding ourselves and reminding our readers that yes, the future is going to happen, but it's unwritten. And mm-hmm. there are actually many different possible futures that we can arrive at. And we collectively get to decide which of those many possible futures we're going to build for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so we have this concept that we call data kindness, mm-hmm. which centers human values, lived experience, and collective deliberation inside of that process of figuring out what the future looks like. So it doesn't become an issue of, well, are we going to move forward or are we going to try to push things backwards? It becomes an issue of how can we together move forward into a shared vision of the future in which the potential harms of technology are mitigated and the potential benefits are maximized, mm-hmm. so that we can live lives of dignity, so that we can maintain a diverse and continually evolving and polyvocal society, so that the most vulnerable among us have their needs met, even as the most ambitious among us have the opportunities to explore the extent of their imaginations. And we've always done this, right? This is not the first major techno-social hurdle that humankind has ever faced. You know, the Industrial Revolution completely changed. I mean, you're an IP professor, you know, about the enclosure movement and its relationship to industrialization, yeah. and to the rise of the bourgeoisie, and ultimately to colonization and all the subjugation that happened in those colonies. We are constantly, as a species and as a global society, navigating the unknown potential harms of our new inventions against the kind of optimistic new avenues of exploration and creativity that are also enabled by these new developments. So you know, this is not in any way like the make or break moment for the human species. We're not afraid that we're, you know, about to enter into a barren hellscape in which only the strong survive from the privacy of their, you know, Mauna Loa bunkers. What we're saying is we could build, if most of us aren't part of this conversation, if most of us aren't part of the decision-making process, then what's most likely is that we will build a society in which technology and data are used to subjugate large swaths of the human population, and we live in a rigidly hierarchical society with a handful of information-rich elites at the top making decisions for everyone else. But that's not the only way we can go. We can actually build systems that privilege multiplicity and that have humans centered in design and that triangulate different perspectives into a kind of tapestry of data rather than trying to force everybody into one rigid vision of what the world looks like. And we have a lot of case studies and expert voices in our book that that point us to various initiatives that move in that direction. And by embracing those kinds of technologies and those kinds of policies and those kinds of commercial actors, we can actually push things that way, and we can make a universe that looks more like Star Trek and less like the Terminator.
The Secret Life of Data, Navigating Hype and Uncertainty in the Age of Algorithmic Surveillance. The secret life being the things that happen afterwards. And that is where the book, aside from the balancing, makes a huge contribution. The authors are Aram Sinreich and Jesse Gilbert. Thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. You're listening
Pleasure
to KZSU.
Thank you,
thank
Dave.
You
so thank much. You. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Check out hearsayculture.com for all of the additional programming on the Hearsay Culture Network, including, and Aram kind of referred to it a little bit, Denise Howell's Uneven Distribution show, which is built off of William Gibson's famous commentary about the future not being evenly distributed, as well as R&D with D&D. And my show, Secrets. Stay tuned for KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.